It was 5:30 on a Friday afternoon when the phone rang. It was August, and so humid that the ballpoint I was using to autograph last month's rent check stuck to my hand like a magnetic tattoo on a four-day-old herring. Outside, the sun sat relentlessly hot and heavy in the sky, beating down with enough intensity to fry the puddles of weasel spit that had collected in the pockets of the South Florida macadam. Agnes was still seated at the switchboard attempting to retrieve voicemail. She had been at it for 7 hours and was convinced that the cyber mailbox could only be accessed from a parallel universe that was rich in hyperspace whimsy. On the 10th ring, she finally answered, but, practicing the art of conceptual redundancy, she didn't actually say anything until she thought about it for a minute. Beadle and Tatum, private investigators, she intoned, her voice... Like that. Her voice edgy but businesslike, if you call pouring sulfuric acid over a side order of pasta salad businesslike. Hello, dear, it's Sister Florenza again. Is Mr. Beadle in? Agnes was many things. A geometric anomaly, a panda in pajamas, a distortion in the gravity chain, a registered charlatan, Antioch's gift horse. But she was not dear in any sense of the word to me or to any other sentient creature in this hemisphere. Although the office was officially closed for the day and I was supposedly out for the rest of the day, she hotwired my speakerphone and transferred the call. Hello, Bailey, it's... She need not have said any more. Instantly I recognized the dank contralto of Sister Florenta of the Church of the Divine Approximation, an order of retro Trappist lady monks whose grasp on reality mystified even the most devout postulants. The hearing receptors of my brain dove for cover, but it was too late. The clergywoman had already begun to describe her church's new position on the law of approximate phonetic displacement, followed by some gibberish about the Appleby layer's effect on collection plate dust bunnies. Much as I wanted to hang up, I couldn't.
Oh, bet.
The church was one of our last paying clients. I had to be at least outwardly attentive. While Sister Florenta spoke of aqualung-toting smugglers who had purloined 100,000 earthworms from an exhibit at the new Bodleian Library down in Key West, I sat fidgeting with my tie, fashioning several unusual knots. The Pirate Jenny, the Model 3 Banger, the Flemish Fisherman's Bend, the Flambeau Orange, the transverse crushed sesame. But when I tied that last hitch, a light bulb clicked on in the refrigerator section of my mind, and I suddenly remembered a tasty confection I'd stashed in the bottom drawer of my desk. Rummaging through stacks of long-forgotten bills, I triumphantly pulled out a loaf of halva, hard as a brick after untold weeks in unhermetically sealed hiding. Stale, but still delicious. And as I broke off and chewed on a chunk, I reflected that, no matter their devout intent and fine black-and-white duds, a halva loaf is better than none.
Oh, all right. Please continue. I'll just sit here in the corner with my flambeau orange.
Do. The premises of Calvos and Damien's new music bazaar are, as usual, bereft of halva or any other snack. However, the show in general, and this 134th episode in particular, does have plenty of other succulent harmonic morsels to curb the musical appetite of even the most discriminating listener, including, but not limited to, for example, E.G., I.E., V.I.Z., Calvos.
The pun still hurts.
It should.
It does. Let's finish listening to Dave Heath's The Frontier, and then I'll nurse the pain. Dave Heath, The Frontier, I almost said New Frontier, The Frontier from a compact disc simply called, or minimally called, Minimalist.
Yeah, but it's...
With otherwise otherwise music by Philip Glass, Steve Reich, and John Adams.
Well, you know, it was in the cutout bin. I wanted to take a chance.
Yes, you did. Well, that's not a bad tune. That's got some excitement, drive, thrill to it. Today is our the beginning of our marathon interview with Laurie Spiegel, which was recorded actually in March 14th of 1996.
I wonder if any of this is still applicable.
Well, interestingly enough, I got an email from Laurie a few days ago saying, I see my long-forgotten interview is finally being broadcast. The interesting thing is that since that was recorded, I totally changed my ideas that I expressed in the interview, but it's been so long that I've changed them back. So, fresh and refreshed Laurie Spiegel at the hour in about 20 minutes.
Mm.
And Laurie's Music Mouse is her most famous program on which she has created a number of pieces, and she has a great fascination with mice. So today... Rodent Day
good,
on
the good.
Bazaar.
You recall that when we did stay there, she did have a family of rodents in her stove, which sang to her.
Yes,
and
they
to
did.
Us.
They did. They eventually, according to a continuum of emails, became an extended family with full choral effects, a crowd with threatening characteristics, and finally a bleeding mob, which she was almost forced to flambé with feline, but she doesn't have a feline, so she, I think, stuck it out, and they went elsewhere on their own.
Ah, all right. All
well,
good.
Let's begin the Rodent Day celebration, the Day of Rodents.
Yum. How?
With just a kind of an introductory framework. This is Richard Powers' Zoometry, piece for two-channel tape. This is from Wave Formation, the University of Illinois' academic kind of electronic stuff. But Zoometry sounds both
fitting.
Rodent-like and academic, too. Here it is. Thank you.
Meet the girl. squeak, 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 the Pomeranian launch. Squeak, 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 we pray I'm in the right of the line. Squeak, 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 we sing with basic bread. Squeak, 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 we'll eat and eat and we'll be treated as they are.
I'm going to go to the hospital. Thank you.
A regatta of rodents.
Yes, yes. Do explain the regattedness of this.
Well, just to get us in the mood for Laurie Spiegel and her discussion of Music Mouse and her affection for mice, we heard at the top Richard Powers' Zoometry, followed by Carl Stalling's Slap Hoppy Mouse.
A dandy tune. It's just not played enough in symphonic concerts.
It certainly is not. Plus, then we followed it up by Chris Konigsberg's The Rat's Nest. Probably more airplay on the Calvos and Damien show on WGDR Plainfield than any other little element of musical association.
I wonder if BMI is listening and knows how often it's being performed.
I wouldn't know. And then following that, David Gunn's Mice in a performance from when?
Burlington, 1989, at an environmentally aware concert.
So you wrote about mice, did you?
Naturally.
Ah. And that was mixed in and followed by Laurie Spiegel's Cavus Murus, Part 3. That's the hole in the wall for mice.
Yeah.
Part 3, and then we had David Gunn, once again a mice man from way back, Armies of Mice from 1982 performance.
Another live performance as only they can be.
It's at Chandler Music Hall in beautiful downtown Randolph, Vermont, in its newly restored condition. They were, as a matter of fact, reluctant to rent us the space because it was so brand spanking newly restored.
And that was still when, what was the ensemble performing that piece?
I don't recall.
Was that pre-Nuke Jitters?
I believe it was, yeah, previous to Nuke Jitters. It was the Dashuki Music Theater.
Oh, my word.
Yes, that's what it was, performing in 1982. And then we finished up the set from Hot Rats by Frank Zappa, Peaches and Regalia, of course.
And, of course, a regalia is a group of rats.
Right, so this is a Peaches and a group of rats.
Yes.
Ah, what are Peaches?
That's the small part of the rat underneath the belly. If you cut it open,
yeah.
If you've done any biology,
the little whitish soft spot.
That's it. The white.
Ah,
spot.
So the whitish soft spot in the regalia of rats.
Yes, yes. Botanically, that's correct.
I imagine it would be. Ooh, I think we should go to our interview shortly with Laurie Spiegel.
She wasn't so short. She's just kneeling a lot.
Is that what it was? Yeah, we were placed around a little low table with Pooch. Digi-Dog was there.
Right, yes, yes. I was thinking of something, some beverage, but I don't recall.
We didn't have any glasses of Pooch, no. Let's listen first to Laurie Spiegel's Appalachian Grove. This is the piece, one of the first pieces that both of us encountered of Laurie's. This was from 1974, is that what this is? Very early piece. Yes, 1974, Appalachian Grove, music by Laurie Spiegel. Thank you.
So,
it's the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquihour on the road.
Well, we're not really on the road. We're off of the road.
We're off the road. We're in the comfy chairs here on at Aesthetic Engine. This is very aesthetic here.
I grant you that. Yes, there. This is a veritable museum
of aesthetics. Precisely. Of computer aesthetics. Anyway, we are on Duane Street in the great New York City.
I don't know that we're allowed to say Duane because I thought this was a private residence.
Is it?
You wanted to keep it.
Well, it's aesthetic engineering.
Well, I started using the name aesthetic engineering because it was much more difficult to do business with a lot of organizations, such as Apple, as an individual that. Their computers, many computers, go nuts if you don't fill in anything on company name in their databases. So I had to have something. And also I was hoping to insulate myself a little bit from people, but I think pretty much everybody knows that it's just a one-person operation in my loft. Doing my thing, which, like all artists, has to interface with the economy to some degree.
But nobody can spell aesthetic.
Yeah, I discovered, much to my amazement, that not only can nobody spell it, an awful lot of people have never heard the word, and that a tremendous number of variations have come into being. I get mail for aesthetic engineering, anesthetic engineering.
That I can understand.
Aesthetic engineering. There have been a whole bunch anyway. That's the one that springs to mind, but let's proceed.
Here at Aesthetic Engineering, our guest today on the show
is
Laurie's Loft. Is Laurie Spiegel.
God knows when. My father was in love with radios the same way people are with computers when they were the new technology, since he was born in 1906. And he built lots of radios for lots of people. My first electronics project from him when I was maybe 9 or 10 was building a crystal radio. So he has, and that mic comes from him. That's like a 1920s kind of a.
So we all built crystal radios. You built a crystal radio.
I did indeed.
Yes, so did I.
Oh, wow.
I had connected my crystal radio to the light socket, causing some unusual problems at one point, but getting Radio Moscow.
Wow. I just used the radiator. And you?
I believe I connected it to small animals, and I didn't get very good reception, but I got a great response from the animals. That's about all.
Our guest today is Laurie Spiegel. Yes.
The Spiegel catalog fortune.
Alas, not.
No?
No.
Oh, I brought down in the car, we had a couple of Spiegel catalogs. We thought you would autograph one.
Well, I could autograph it, but I don't think it will get you a discount or anything.
Oh, that's a shame.
My father has a cousin who worked for them, I believe, as an underwear buyer or something like that for many years.
I knew there was a connection.
And he used to be able to call up places and say, this is Mr. Spiegel's Spiegel catalog, and get a tremendous response, but he was actually... Not of the Spiegels, just, came over during the war from Germany like so many other people and kind of did whatever happened professionally here.
Sort of a mirror image of the
Spiegel image.
So let's hear your story. This is actually a rather remarkable tale.
Am I supposed to have a story?
Yeah.
Well, my dog has a remarkable tale.
This is true. The dog is rather... Digi-dog. Digi-dog!
Gone.
Mr. Dog.
We need not necessarily encourage the return.
He's probably got his nose out the window listening for what's happening at the dog run.
So you've been composing for a really long time. Whose machine was that?
Thanks. That's this one.
Ah.
It wanted to answer that question.
Yes, so it did.
But you know that as a fact. I was composing for a long, long time. Goes without saying that now I'm decomposing. But, is there a follow-up question to that?
Yeah,
that's a yes or
I
no
mean,
question.
That, sure it is. But you were a lutenist for a while? Still are?
No.
Is that like a Calvinist?
Cross between a Calvinist and a Lutheran is a Lutonist?
I believe so.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, once you get out of practice on it, and it takes so long to get it in tune that by the time it's in tune again, all of your impetus for starting to practice has kind of gone by the wayside, and your free time for doing so, you have to really plan ahead several days.
It's like Peking duck for lute.
And then, well, of course, I played other plucked instruments before the lute. Guitar, I still attempt to play once in a while, but since I am totally out of practice and don't have my calluses, I usually get carried away the first time, and then I end up getting blisters on all my fingers, and they hurt too much, and then I can't play again for a while. So then it breaks the impetus, too. Keyboards, on the other hand, you don't need calluses, and they stay in tune relatively well compared to lutes, so... I do sometimes play keyboards, even though I was much better at plucked instruments.
So
started keyboards very late.
So how does a you spent?
What does that got to do with anything?
It's history. No, I mean
history.
History, because we've
played. Yeah, I love counterpoint.
Okay, we've played your music on the air a lot so far. We've played most of Unseen Worlds, and you know a piece here and a piece there. We played Carus and Murus. We've played. And we've even played things from Expanding Universe, which was the first things we played on the air from 20 years ago. And so how does, here's the question you've been asked 1,000 times, here it comes again, how does somebody who played plucked instruments and probably a great deal of traditional music and spent, as I think you said, some time in the English countryside and such, end up doing engineering, computer programming, composition using masses of electronics? Here in your studio, we're surrounded by electronics of every generation from the time we were all little sprouts.
And on this side, we have a Baroque lute, a sitar, a Clementi square piano built around 1810, and a whole bunch of other stuff. A dulcimer, a mandolin, which was my first instrument. My grandmother from Lithuania played it and gave me one when I was about the same age as when I did the crystal radio thing. Some banjos. The odd thing is that despite the number of different systems, computers, somebody commented once that about equal distribution of computers and musical instruments in this place. but just about every one of them is one that I've had like a long, intense involvement with. They're not just here because I collect them or something, but there sure are a lot of them. And each one of them is like a whole different bunch of stories, probably.
But how did you start? How did you end up at Bell Labs, for example? I mean, how did you begin using those media to create your music?
Well, at that point, I was already had been working for several years with analog stuff,
mm-hmm.
Buchla, modular, and at a certain point, Miz is just like, you know, it's a stupid little factual story that you asked for.
Yeah, we got to have the stupid factual story.
One of the other people working in the Buchla studio, which was the old NYU Composers Workshop, that was sort of what was left of Mort Spotnik's old Bleecker Street studio, which is where I first saw a synthesizer.
Did it captivate you instantly? Is that how you got
into it?
Yeah,
I pretty much did. It really. I was at that time studying at Juilliard, where they didn't even acknowledged that there was any possibility that electronic music was real music or was music. And writing things that, of course, I never heard, you know.
Right.
And it was just awesome working with the real sounds. It was more like working as a, you know, as a painter, because you're working on actual work, or a writer, where you're working on the thing which will be the experience that someone will have, that you can experience it, you can hear the sounds, and with scores, of course, it's a mind game. It's all in your imagination, and I really kind of did fall in love with them. But anyway, I had gotten to the point that I was just really fed up by the lack of control, the lack of replicability, that you couldn't get a patch back exactly the same and continue working on it. Editing techniques were extremely crude and limited to, you know, tape splicing.
Right. Well, sort of to back up for some of the listeners, that when you say replicability, when you turn these older synthesizers on, everything affected them. Temperature, it seemed humidity, it seemed like time of day affected whether it was going to be in tune.
I'm sorry, but I just...
Well, you
know. I can't pick up the thread quite where I left it off. It's going to be a lousy transition, but okay. Something like...
You were saying in your apartment.
I was off on a tangent, and I can finish the tangent, but I won't get back on the main thread, and I'll sound scatterbrained, but okay, so here it goes. Yeah, the Electrocom synthesizer that was probably the first one... It was the first synthesizer I actually owned. When the refrigerator would cycle on, it would drop half the oscillators, probably, roughly, would drop 3/8 to a semitone, and then they'd go back up when the refrigerator cycled off. I mean, I have a 5-room apartment on a 15-amp fuse, and I'm picking up this dog panting?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. But that was... a relatively minor thing. I mean, obviously, I unplugged the refrigerator when I was recording and plugged it back in after. But the simplicity of the control logic was frustrating after a while. And in 1971, okay, I've always been somewhat active in various visual arts, and there was a place called The Kitchen that was at point just a video center and with some theatrical stuff. And Reese Chatham, who was working, we figured out the booklet together. We basically learned the booklet together.
Well, Reese will be joining us on our show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Reese is an old friend. In fact, it's sort of almost to some degree like a brother and sister relationship. We haven't seen each other for eons. He stayed in this loft for a few months at one point, too. A lot of people have lived here during various periods. Anyway, losing my thread. Anyway, Reese Chatham decided to start an informal concert series at The Kitchen where composers would basically be able to play works in progress and things like that for each other and have a dialogue among composers in a performance context. And in order to launch the thing, he invited, you know, his best friends basically to come and give some concerts. So I had stuff in 2 out of the first 4 concerts, and one of the other 2 of the first 4 concerts was Max Matthews and Emmanuel Gent doing some stuff that knocked me out because they were using computer controlled analog synthesis with the groove system. So eventually, working up all my guts, I called up Manny and asked if I could study with him because I wanted to learn this. And he said he didn't take students, and we worked out, well, I'd sort of be like his apprentice and I would, you know, help him this and that. So that worked out, and so I went out as Manny's kind of apprentice assistant for, I think, like 3 months, you know, reading over Fortran listings and helping try to figure out how to debug them and learning how everything got patched and stuff and the lay of the land and the computer technology. And then Max, who had, you know, gotten to know during that period, after about 3 months, he kind of asked me a couple technical questions about how would you go about doing this and that, and I felt like I was being suspiciously tested anyway, but he issued me my clearance, my badge, and all that stuff, so then I had official resident visitor status, which I continued to have throughout the 70s, and did a fair amount of work in computer graphics, computer video, as well as the music stuff.
And that's
how that transition happened. How things happen is always very serendipitous, I think. I got into all of that in the first place because having been basically initially a folk instrument musician playing plucked instruments, at a certain point when I was going crazy for various reasons and had dropped out of college and wasn't really doing anything gratifying, I just felt like my guitar playing was in a complete rut. So I decided to teach myself to read notes and transcribed all of the Bach part inventions for guitar and you know, all this, you know, and basically started doing a lot of transcriptions and learned notes. And then when I was studying in England, I studied classic guitar with Jack Duarte in London, who, well, I was there to study other things. I was really an intellectual. I'm still an intellectual. I did a residence, a one-year residence thing at Oxford University, and was being extremely abstract and philosophical. I discovered when I talked about Aristoxenes and things like that, people kind of weren't that interested, but if I just sat in the corner and played the guitar, they kind of liked it. So that sort of began winning out. Anyway,
in that regard, our listeners would be very gratified if you were to play for them Michael Rowe, The Boat Ashore. That's really something that we've been looking forward to since coming down here.
Well, that isn't exactly the kind of stuff I tended to like.
Oh,
but
we're
misinformed. It's okay.
We're
no,
crushed.
It's okay. It's okay. No, I like that one. It was like, oh, I mean, I literally was one of these people who would carry a banjo on a peace march, you
I
know.
See.
No, on my back. Just when I was playing it. But no, I liked a lot of the Southern Mountain modal clawhammer style stuff, sawmill tuning, real old time, you know, ballads, and I liked blues a lot. I'm from Chicago, and
yeah,
I heard a lot of wonderful blues playing. Played a little, not that well. I loved John Fahey's music. It was a big influence on me. Anyway, basically, my teacher in London, like I went to study guitar with him on the weekends, commuting up to London from Oxford, and I had begun writing down some of my improvisations just so I wouldn't forget them, and he pointed out to me that that was called composing, which is not a word I would have ever dreamed of applying to myself or anything I might ever do, but that I should consider taking it seriously and practicing every day and writing something, writing music every day, and if I threw it away, that was fine. The thing is to just get the practice writing it and do it. So I started, you know, writing, and then he started teaching me more theory and counterpoint and stuff like that, and somehow after my first year in New York, which was pretty horrendous, I decided to just give myself a year to see how far I'd get in music because I really loved it, and I ended up succeeding. And at the end of that year, I was teaching at a community college, teaching music. I was working pretty steadily doing soundtrack work. I had, you know, music students and stuff like that, and I was functioning professionally. Whereas the first year I was in New York, I could not get any work that didn't start with how fast do you type. I mean, coming in from like Oxford University to how fast can you type was just, you know, it was rather a downer. And I had even gone to IBM to apply to go to their computer programming training school because it just seemed interesting, and because I'd always been interested in science and math and liked them. And they told me, and I think this was probably utterly sexist because I turned out to be an okay programmer, but they told me that I had absolutely not any aptitude for working with computer technology.
Oh, terrific. That's very nice. Well, let me interrupt.
I think it must have just been a sexual stereotype.
It sounds
I don't know,
like
just
it.
Either that or they looked at my social science degree and said,
well, that was suspicious anyway.
It wasn't hard science, yeah. Too much.
You have anything, any music recordings from that early day, those early days? Anything?
Yeah, I have. Well, I have a lot of recordings, yeah. I don't know what state they're in.
Horn concerto?
No.
No?
You mean concerto for horn and hard art? I think Peter Shickley
did
that.
He did that, but I thought maybe you had a...
Oh, God, I had a friend who was a horn player that wanted me to write something for him, and I could just somehow never work up to writing him a piece for that instrument. It wasn't one that I warmed up to.
The world's loss.
Well, let's hear something of that early. of that early music. With the exception of a few vocal notes at the beginning, that was
someone announcing the piece. the piece was played.
The voice of Joan LaBarbera just briefly intruding in there in our cueing of that, and followed by what we intended to play, Cavus Muris, the first movement of that for computer music on tape from 1986. We'll go right back to the Laurie Spiegel interview, but an interesting thing happens throughout the interview, and what's about to come up is one of them. Laurie has this most remarkable associative ability. As she converses, as she explains what she's done, it reminds her of something else. She promises at this moment that she will play for us the history of music in one movement. However, the conversation zigs and zags until she never gets to the point of actually introducing the piece, and she never actually provided us with a recording of it.
Which made us believe that it never really existed, only in her fantasy world.
It could be. So let's go back to New York City on March 14th, 1996.
Now, we passed her folk period. And
skipped briefly over her lutenist stage.
Yes, and we're now quickly approaching her symphonic output.
Let's go back to New York.
This is my history of music in one movement for solo piano, although I first publicly performed it on an Apple II computer.
Okay. You know. We can get away from the acoustic immediately.
Well, it is a piano piece, though, and it goes through all the historical styles. I sort of felt like I wanted to experience being in each historical style and feeling internally the need to move forward to break out into the next style. I mean, to be in the late Baroque, wanting to move into the classical state of mind. So I read that, and it was a really wonderful experience writing, and I enjoyed it a lot.
How far did you get into history? Did you bring it right up to the...
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, but I, of course, the piece comes with a caveat. This history, if I can remember, this history does not purport to be any more objective, comprehensive, or unbiased than any other history. So, obviously, I will have spent time with the Impressionists and Bartok, but I forced myself to write a couple bars of pointillist serial material for historical accuracy, but I hate those combo measures.
Oh, good.
But by and large, the rest of it flowed. The way I rationalized that was that essentially history, it starts with just playing with the materials and seeing what happens with them, and musical patterns and things evolve, and it gets gradually more and more emotional through all these cycles of, you know, what Nietzsche would call the Dionysian and Apollonian alternating, but basically the overall thrust is that it gets more and more dramatic and emotional through the late 19th century until music has a real breakdown in the 20th century. It goes off the deep end and breaks down, and that's where you have this post-Webernite episode. And
you don't care for that, is that what you're saying?
No, that was what was stuffed down our throats and force-fed us when I was studying composition, and it was just not my thing. And it just has a lot of bad vibes because of the pressure that was brought to bear and the judgmental attitudes of many people.
That is not the first time we've heard composers on the show say that.
Well, at this point in history, it's easy to say that because it's not the same atmosphere it was in the early 70s. I mean, I was studying at Juilliard from 1969 to 72.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, the things that I had in common between my electronic music that I was doing secretly downtown that couldn't be brought in to Juilliard, on the Buchla and, you know, the stuff I would play at the kitchen and stuff in my off hours versus the lute music, which also Renaissance music had, early music hadn't really begun to become a major staple of the known, recorded, and concertized repertoire. So that was also, I mean, it's just, I got a very good background in general at Juilliard in many ways, but the particular things that I was into were kind of all outsider things. Also, I was, during that period, I was steadily doing soundtrack work. I was staff composer for a small educational film and film strip company.
Now, how did you get that job? I mean, how do you get a job like that?
Well, I got that one, actually, Frederick Jevsky gave it to me because he didn't want it anymore. And then I got some work also from my very good friend for a long time, Mike Saul, who got me into music editing in the late 70s. So I did a lot of that kind of, you know, cutting room stuff, chopping. But it balanced Juilliard. I mean, we had Juilliard with this attitude that redundancy should be eliminated from music, whereas I felt, having studied lots of kinds of psychology as an undergraduate and everything else, and just intuitively, that redundancy is one of the most essential components of music. And in fact, perceived redundancy is an essential component to aesthetic experience in the temporal domain, I think. And I always felt that Boulez was a very dominant force in the 70s in New York, obviously, because he was here.
Right, right.
I always felt that was just, in terms of just plain cognitive psychology, totally off base. And I didn't enjoy it. But that, you know, it's a personal case. I know a lot of other people do, but when I wanted to put something on the record player just to listen to a piece of music, it just never was Boulez or Webern.
Because, in other words, you're saying that people have to hear something a couple of times to understand and to feel, to sense out? What do you mean by redundancy?
One way of achieving redundancy is to play the same piece over and over, which is how it is that when a person listens to a serial piece that prohibits redundancy, they eventually come to appreciate it because they begin to be able to predict everything because they've heard it a whole bunch of times.
Okay.
Because music is, for one thing, it is the manipulation of human expectation to create emotion, and it's many other things besides that, but that's one of the primary things that it allows an artist to do, is to deal with human emotion by manipulating levels of expectation, disappointment, gratification. And you look at all of the great forms and processes from history, fugue, rondo, sonata, canon, passacaglia, repetition is an inherent component of structure in most of the dominant forms. Even, you know, it's a normal strophic form of song that everybody knows. I personally felt that added to that could be the extrapolative method, that you didn't have to use redundancy to structure a piece of music, but you had to have something which would allow the mind to be able to feel for what would come next so that what happened next would relate to that in a meaningful way as being different or same or moving into a new light or, you know, all of the different emotional things that can happen moment to moment in music, that can be done either with repetition through variation and alteration, or it can be done through extrapolation. Trends in sonic data, which tend to continue in certain directions, are likely to continue so that, for example, if you're making a crescendo and you're adding temporal density during the crescendo, you can create an emotional climax within that crescendo by building the timbre along with the amplitude, and then at a certain point taking the timbral thing down until it's very thin again while the amplitude and the range continue to expand, and then bringing the timbral stuff back up again, that can be more powerful than just keeping them all in sync.
Mm-hmm.
And that can only happen because the mind is expecting the continuity, and then it feels something emotionally when that one component goes against the grain of the rest of the continuities and then returns to it.
The question.
This is kind of like an offbeat method of music theory, but that's sort of the kind of way I tend to think.
Okay. Well, I mean, one of the things that keeps cycling around in my own questions about how people compose is, how much do you think your audience can hear? Now, you say that, okay, the question of redundancy comes up.
But you
give us an illustration, a change of timbre versus a change of dynamic.
That
and do you think it's
actually an illustration of extrapolation rather than redundancy.
But regardless of what it's an illustration of, your suggestion is that it's more hearable or more what are you trying to get out by saying that serialists are not
what
memorable?
What I'm trying to get at is feelings.
Okay.
What I'm trying to get at is the fact that there's a tremendous amount of not verbally articulatable experience we each have internally in isolation that, in fact, we share, and that music is a way of making tangibly common that which we've been very isolated in, that we get something out of that. Make part of the common public human vocabulary of acknowledged experiences stuff that's virtually inarticulatable, that has to do with how we feel and how we feel about our experience of being alive, that we really do have in common but don't have enough of a way to find in common. That's really sort of a bottom line. But how I get to the other stuff, the structural stuff, is really just listening. I think maybe if I have any advantages as a composer, one of the ones that I thought was that one of the biggest disadvantages was, which turned out to be probably a great strength, was that I started out listening to music a lot and playing by ear without notation, particularly not conceiving of myself as someone who might ever go into music until my early 20s, so that what I liked and what I felt about music were all pretty, my values and my tastes were all pretty much together before I set about learning the techniques of writing and composing.
Thank you.
values and my tastes were all pretty much together before I set about learning the techniques of writing and composing in any structured way, and before I really had a head-on encounter with the way various types of established music theory conceptualized musical structure and material. So I had a lot of stuff worked out in my head. And I particularly had my values worked out from a listener's perspective. And this is completely different from, you know, the shock of discovering where all of the rest of the kids at Juilliard mostly come from, where they've all been reading notes since before they could read letters of the alphabet. They have never really experienced music without it fitting into this notational and conceptual language. They've never experienced it without that intervening in their mind as a filter between them and just the sensual experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have, from the beginning, most of them had their identities and ego tied up with their involvement such that they would tend to favor things that they did best rather than things that they just enjoyed most hearing or things that they got the most praise for or whatever, that there are all kinds of non-musical factors in how you grow up being a child prodigy that I didn't go through growing up being a listener who never expected to go into music but just loved it.
So how does that take us to how you use the, if I can phrase it this way, the machines?
You sure it's not that they're using me?
Okay. We'll take it. Either way, how is the music coming out? I mean, you know, there's a really strong, you make a point of the sort of strong emotional component, the strong affective sort of sense. Yet, you sit in this incredible studio and work with a panoply of wires and
this
screens.
This is nothing compared to the early days. I showed you earlier the prototype 48K Apple II with the 8080A breadboard computer sitting on top of it with an audio patch bay that I built coming out with a whole bunch of capacitors, resistors, and potentiometers sticking inside
right.
of those breadboards. Yeah, that I used to perform on. God, you know, times have changed. It's a complicated process, but I really try to use real-time interactive methods of creating and controlling sound that I can relate to on a physical as well as an intellectual level. And in order to do that, I have to spend months or years programming and writing software based on my own analysis of the kinds of control I want and refining that. And I also have to figure out what can be automated, which is anything that I know how I would do something in a given situation I should automate in order to be clear to be able to focus on.
Give me an example of what that would be.
One of the first things that I did that could be totally automated was in the expanding universe, you'll hear it, a little algorithm that simply puts notes on whichever speaker has the fewest notes sounding so that overall there's a stereo balance maintained and you don't end up with all the voices being on this channel instead of that one.
Mm-hmm, okay.
That's really the kind of thing that I can do without thinking about that while I'm actually making the music, and it can do a better job than I probably could, and it's not that important. There are other cases where I want to do pans by hand, such as in Passage, where I did all of those variable faders by hand, you know, all of those long lines of ups and downs and crosswises. There are certain aspects, for example, in my program Music Mask, of harmony that can be easily automated. You can track something with doublings very, very simply. Double at X interval, the third, fifth, the tenth, whatever, and go major, minor, this or that, and then, you know, beyond that, within Music Mouse or, you know, all the other variations that you can switch in and out of, parallel, contrary motion. The harmony gets a little dicier and contrary, obviously, especially in two voices both going contrary and all trying to lock up. And then you introduce a rhythmic component and have them voice themselves. But a lot of this stuff can be done. It depends, you know, each piece with its own piece of generative software brings up different problems, and in each piece I want to reserve different variables for my real-time control.
Okay.
But some of the variables I began working with from the very beginning were very, what you consider, high-level abstract ones. I mean, if you're playing an instrument, you are physically controlling and have to control the timbre and articulation of every single pitch, as well as selecting which pitch and when.
Mm-hmm.
With computer logic, you can work with parameters such as the rate of change itself, which maybe in the Baroque people might recognize as the concept of harmonic rhythm. But I wrote a continuo generator once, actually.
Ooh.
That's a continuo generator that had as one of its variables changing the harmonic rhythm in various ways. I wrote that for a friend once for one concert. This is something that we've verged on touching in a number of points.
Okay.
Which is information theory, which
All right.
is a big thing at Bell Labs, and is a big thing for me, because the redundancy question, basically, okay, in communications theory a la Shannon, information theory, you have a communications channel, and you have an encoder, and you have a decoder, and you have noise. And for different kinds of noise in different situations, you have to figure out what kind of signal is going to get through best.
Mm-hmm.
And what Shannon did was he basically reduced that to a science. He came up with formulas for finding the optimal mix of that which is predictable, redundancy, and that which is not predictable, which is the unexpected, which is information. Something that tells you something you really did not know before and couldn't have predicted is information. And for different kinds of noise, of course, you have different levels of various variables. I mean, there's speed, amplitude, repetition, patterns, the lengths of the patterns that may be repeated. For example, as the some of these spacecraft that have gone further and further out, such as the Voyagers, my understanding is that they will repeat each bit more times as they get further away, and the signal gets fainter, and the noise, that way you're more likely to be able to accurately reconstruct the data it's sending, so that in the beginning it only maybe repeats something a couple of times, but after it gets way out there, it might repeat something each bit many times to make sure that it gets through. Now Shannon, well, John Pierce, who was at Bell Labs, was a really brilliant person, basically wrote a book based on Shannon's work where he also spent some time dealing with the application of information theory to musical structure and looking basically at different types of music as having different amounts of redundancy. And, of course, the theory doesn't deal with meaning, just information.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see in different styles and different types of music that there are different balances of redundancy and new unpredictable information. And in fact, that toward a climax, generally, you have more new information, less predictability, and tension heightens. And then there's a resolution to something which becomes essentially, you know, but you can structure curves of musical or emotional drama out of changes in informational entropy. And you can program a computer, and this is the kind of stuff I was into at Bell Labs in the 70s, where you can have a variable that will control something like informational entropy and have all the notes and stuff being generated, but having whatever variables you wish in terms of, you know, timing, pitch content, whatever, tessitura, these variables responsive to high-level variables that let you control the essential moment-to-moment predictability of the material. And then, because you're dealing with a very small number of very powerful variables instead of a large number of weak ones, you have hands and mind free to also accompany that with real-time input in the timbral domain. For example, I used to use a three-dimensional joystick to control envelope decay length, amount of reverb mix, and filter cutoff for low-pass filters in real-time with one hand while playing variables, probabilistic or entropy-based variables and various kinds of things like that, with the other hand on knobs.
That from the groundbreaking 1980 album, The Expanding Universe, one long piece on both sides of an LP by L.S. Laurie Spiegel.
Much like her interview, one long continuous interview.
Yes.
Punctuation free.
Well, it wasn't punctuation free. It was sort of free of full stop.
Yeah.
There were
free
lots
association.
Lots of semicolons, and there were lots of M dashes and frequent use of colons and lists and numbers and certainly a plethora of commas and a true regalia of parentheses.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, listen to the rest of our interview with Laurie Spiegel next week, at which you will hear Calvos's great debacle at attempting to use Music Mouse.
You see, you debacleize it, but it is not. It is just another concept of approaching the instrument.
Yes, the fact that I was missing one half of the brain, whichever one was required for using Music Maps.
Just push it along and it works, and it worked for you.
Oh, it worked for me, all right.
And I'm sure it'll work for our audience.
You'll hear
on
the panic in my voice.
Music panic. Panic mouse.
Panic mouse. Let's listen to one more Laurie Spiegel piece before we go to some new releases that we received this week. This is one of her most powerful pieces. She talked a lot about emotional content. This is Riding the Storm from 1990. From Unseen Worlds, Compact disc by Laurie Spiegel from Aesthetic Engineering. That was Riding the Storm from 1990.
A charming tune, great melody, something you can dance to. I think it influenced the hip-hoppers of the 90s.
It must have. You know, if you put that on, crank that up on the old stereo, the radio system needs to keep the signal at a level that doesn't interfere with other stations, doesn't go over certain power ratings, so that it compresses the sound. So what you hear is not the dynamic range in the original piece that Laurie Spiegel composed. I had to not only twist the knob on the panel as the piece played, but the compression electronics in the radio station also went to work. So you didn't hear that dynamic range. Best to go right out and get a copy of this and listen to it, because at its peak volume level, it's a real cone ripper for your speakers.
Yes. In another matter, and you brought this up, or someone brought this up, that they had not heard mention on this part of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield, the station identification. But if you listen to the recording of the interview, which we concluded not 10 minutes ago, you will have heard Laurie Spiegel herself say it, although in the context in which she said it, you really didn't hear it. But if you listen and play it back slowly, or if you reverse polarity, you will hear her say WGDR Plainfield.
She says WGDR Plainfield?
She says WGDR Plainfield.
Amazing. You have new releases. What do you got?
Oh, well, I was captivated by the name of the ensemble, the Trondheim Soloists.
Trondheim Soloists. This is good.
This is very
Trondheim.
Good.
Trondheim. Trondheim. Yes.
Right, they're from upstate Norway, and it didn't matter what they were playing, as long as it was played by the Trondheim Soloists.
Okay, well, play something.
They have a tune by Bertel Palmer Johansson and Tjerke Björklund, but they're all long, and we want to reach quota, so we're going back to an old Shostakovich.
Oh, no.
Just a
really?
Movement.
All right, go ahead.
From his string quartet, arranged by the Trondheim Soloists.
Oh, good.
For the Trondheim Soloists. This is the second movement from his Sinfonia for String Orchestra, the Allegro Molto.
Thank you.
The Trondheim soloists.
The happy Trondheim.
The happy Trondheimers wailing through Shostakovich's 8th string chord second movement quartet.
Piece.
Yeah, Allegro Molto's second movement.
Speaking of wailing through, we have a piece by Eleanor Hovda here in a new release called Coastal Traces. This is a short little tune called Chennai Sky. The remarkable Libby Van Cleave on double reeds in that particular section of Coastal Traces, that called Chennai Sky by Eleanor Hovda.
Nice, tasty tune. Good read.
Tasty
good read work.
Tune. Yes, we'll be able to hear more of that in coming weeks, which includes bits like electric bass and super ball mallet, oboe d'amore, and bowed grand piano innards.
Ah, yes.
Sound good? How about another new piece? This is the third section of Things She Carried, a brand new release from Paul Lansky of Princeton.
All right.
So, well, shall we give it a try?
Please do. Thank you.
third section of Things She Carried by Paul Lansky. That's called Wish in the Dark, produced on Silicon Graphics and Next Computers with some voices, the voice of Hannah McKay. He says a nice, interesting thing about himself. He says, of course, referring to himself in the third person as we do on these kinds of record things. His main concern for the past 25 years has been to find ways to get computers to help tell us musically interesting things about the world around us. Paul Lansky.
Yeah.
So, what do you got there? You got an announcement.
This is the second and concluding weekend to hear The Cradle Will Rock, an American musical by Mark Blitzstein. Tonight at 8, tomorrow at 3 at the City Hall Arts Center in Montpelier. For information, 229-0492. And you're listening right now to a performance with Michael Arnowitt on the piano and a couple of other folks in a concert on the 26th of October in the Barry Opera House.
Can't tell which is which. What have they got? What can they do? What can they do? Support you.
Mark Blitzstein, The Cradle Will Rock, tonight and tomorrow afternoon at the City Hall Arts Center in downtown Montpelier.
Montpelier, Vermont. Very good. Okay.
With Michael Arnowitz still playing piano, but a different cast.
A different cast of characters?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
The name of which eludes me.
Fine.
Yes.
Elude away. Well, one last new release for today. We will have the remainder of our interview, at least I think we'll be able to do the entire remainder of the interview with Laurie Spiegel next week on the show, our marathon interview, where she manages to carry us up basically to 20 years ago in her career. She invited us back to conclude that at some point. Any case, next week on the Callos and Damien New Music Bazaar, we'll hear the rest of the interview with Laurie Spiegel. Don't forget to check out the website for playlists and to hear this interview again if you'd like to, and all our other shows, or most of them, almost 100 of them now available on AudioNet. So look us up on www.maltedmedia.com or go right to the shows at www.audionet.com. And now, as you said, always good for a new tune.
Yes. Mr. Didkowski, Dr. Nerve, has sent us a new CD. The title is Binky Boy. Clever name. This is Eagle the Skald.